Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the It Depends podcast. I am Daniel Pritchett here with David Mohundro.
Hello, how's it going?
All right, and Jesse Brown.
Hey guys.
As always, I want to remind you we have a Twitter account at Clear Function. Reach out to us on the hashtag It Depends, and we'll talk about this episode or future episode topics. Today, our episode is about debugging. We do a lot of it every day, and producer Ben asked us to queue up a technical episode this week, and here we are.
So here's some trivia. I've heard, y'all can confirm or deny, but I've heard that the name debugging comes from some of the old computers, you know, back in the, a long time ago, and basically they were so big, there was literal bugs in the computer. So, you know, it was the size of a room, and so, I don't know. Anyway, trivia for the day.
If it's true.
If it's true.
I have no idea.
I believe it.
I'll find
out. Sounded very confident there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I've heard it from a very reliable source that I can't remember. But so how do y'all approach debugging?
Should we start with what is debugging?
For those
who might be getting bugs out. So debugging is, you know, what you do to try to fix an error that you're unsure of why it's happening. So this is sort of how you get to finding a resolution, finding out what the actual problem is so that you can build the fix that you need to build in your software. Is that a reasonable
thing? That I imagine most anyone today who uses technology of any sort and has encountered a bug, you know, in terms of something, we've all heard the, hey, could you just restart your computer or something like that? but it's, you know, when something isn't working and it's, I guess most of the time, 90% of the time, something in software.
Right.
But yep, we can get into some of the categories of bugs later if we need to.
Sure. Yeah, for me, I guess, from an end user's perspective, if you're not a developer, you may think of debugging as just the process of making the bugs go away. Yeah, right. For me, it's more like finding what the actual problem is. And usually, well, not, I guess, maybe not every time, but I like to imagine that once I know what the problem is, that fixing it is not so hard.
Yep.
Just figuring out what's not doing what you think it's doing. And we got a whole list of topics to go through on debugging, but the fundamental one for me is usually to question everything. Just know that you got to this place because whoever wrote this code assumed that things were going to happen one way, and they clearly didn't. So it's very tempting to start with a really myopic perspective and just look left and right, like, what's the line before this and line after this? What is wrong? But it's quite often you'll find out that something far, far away just didn't quite work the way it was expected to, and it's almost like a butterfly flapping its wings sort of situation where things are just not at all what you think they are.
Yeah, you said a word there that I was going to mention, assumption. You said, you know, someone made assumptions, and that's usually where, that's why I'm debugging most of the time, is some assumption was made that is no longer true for one reason or another.
Right.
And whether that assumption's near where the bug is, irrelevant. But yeah, like, you know, your code is based on assumptions, always is, and always will be. And so, like, the, you know, you can guard those assumptions and make it very obvious when things are not the way they're supposed to be. But but at the end of the day, there's going to be code somewhere, and when it breaks, it's because someone assumes something that's not true.
I often, when someone, when I'm helping someone else figure out what's wrong, I will ask, I will listen for cues where someone says, well, it's not this part. And it's usually something that they wrote, but it's like, okay, show me. I'm like, well, that's not the problem. Yeah. I'm like, show me.
Right.
Because it's very easy for us to assume, like you said, that, well, this part works because it's just a simple three lines of, oh, wait, there it is. You
right. Know? Yeah. I do that a lot if I'm looking over someone's shoulder and we're doing, say, a test-driven design, or even if we're not, I'll kind of force it on them. They'll say, okay, we've got this, this, and this. These parts all work. And I'm like, okay, let's write a simple test that confirms that those three things you just said are true.
Right.
And then that won't take but 5 minutes, right? And then when that's done, we can proceed with a lot more confidence the next step. And like Mo said, it quite often finds the problem.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard to figure out exactly how to say that. You're not, you know, you're not tweaking somebody and you're not forcing them to waste their time. But really, that's just setting a really solid foundation. We know that it's almost certainly not these things because we have this test right in front of us. So we can open up our creativity and find the problem in this area.
A good analogy for this, at least I think, is you know when you're typing up an email,
right?
And you have looked over that thing multiple times. Mm-hmm. There are no spelling errors. As soon as you click send, though, that's when you see it.
Oh, yeah.
Someone else walks over, they see it, too. Mm-hmm. It's you can't see it because you wrote it.
Yeah.
You know?
The context changes after the fact. Like, if you write a 5-paragraph email,
right,
suddenly in the 4th paragraph, you decide to change tense from future to present or from him to her or vice versa, and that doesn't break the spell checker, but then you go back and reread your first line. You're like, oh, that made sense when I started writing this email half an hour ago, and now it has nothing to do with where I ended up.
Yep. Same thing happens in code. It's just, I know exactly what... Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to kind of be careful. You mentioned, like, you know, being over someone's shoulder and being like, yeah, prove to me that part works. Now, obviously, that, like you said, there is a good chance that the part that they're skipping over might be the source of the bug.
Yeah, because if that wasn't the problem...
But you can go too far, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, it just... It led me to think of, like, another coworker that I used to work with. They were pretty good about doing what you said. They're like, I'd be like, hey, I have a problem with this one line of code. Like, come look at this code. And they're like, what about those lines above you? And so, like, I got in the habit of, like, just putting blank lines before and after the part that I was asking them about. And just to avoid that conversation, because I'm like, I know this has nothing to do with it. Like, I didn't want them to get distracted. They would get distracted on, like, the other part that, like, I wasn't intending to change for any reason. Now, that could be good or bad, right? This was years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know your audience of who's over your shoulder and helping you out. And, try not to let them get lost in the weeds. Mm-hmm. If you know without a doubt that is not the problem, you know, try to make sure that the part that you think is the problem is isolated enough that you have all the inputs and the outputs.
Isolation.
So that's actually another one, is isolating the problem. Another way that I sort of think about this is to be able to reproduce the problem in isolation. So that means, though, like, you don't want to have the bug where it only shows up every 5th day or something like that. It's like
every 29th.
There's no way for you to reliably fix that. You're not, you know, it's like you don't want to, you know, change your system clock or something like that to try to reproduce this.
And by the way, do you guys feel terrible like I do when you have to tell an end user or business stakeholder, I can't fix this because I can't reproduce your problem?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not a great feeling.
Yeah, it's like, I believe you, or at least I'm saying I believe you, but I have no means of reproducing this, so I don't know. Next time it happens, call me and I'll drive over there. I don't know. Yeah.
There was a guy I used to work with. He was the best at reproducing issues. Mm-hmm. And even if it was something like where it was seemed very sporadic, he was able to come up with a reproducible test case.
Right.
And in one example, it was a browser where, you know, some site within the intranet at the time had, it was like however many form fields on it. And if you had like some ridiculous number of them, I think there was some JavaScript that was dynamically adding them.
Right.
And he found if there was this number, then it would actually break the post.
Oh, that's a good one. That happens a lot. You get a little tickle in the back of your mind. You're like, not only is this breaking, but it takes exactly 5.0 seconds to break every time. Like, things like that. Mm-hmm. You notice unnaturally perfect numbers and errors. That sort of thing is really often a clue.
When you start looking at, like, 8s and 16s, you're like, oh, wait a minute. Like, somewhere there's something that's, like, out of bounds or like, you know, we're hitting size thresholds that we didn't realize.
Yeah.
Like, like you do, you know, after a while you do sort of realize, you're like, oh yeah, I hit, like, this is exactly 50 meg.
Mm-hmm.
Like when it's 50.1, it breaks. Like, oh, this is a clear place of probably something somewhere is limiting it to 50 meg or whatever. You know? And so you get used to looking for those little things.
Guy online calls that psychic debugging, where it's like they can just look at something and someone else has been spending, you know, usually hours to days.
Right.
And you just walk over and it's like, hey, check this. And it looks like it has nothing to do with what they're working on. But it's because you have seen that same type of problem before. Jesse was saying, you know, it's like, pull up your process monitor, pull up your task manager. Let me see other stuff running. Oh, yep. I see the other process. That's the problem. I'm like, what?
Right.
And it's just because you've seen those things. Oh, yeah.
So that doesn't really sound super encouraging.
to our listeners. Right.
But that is a good point. If you can see any kind of consistent numbers, it couldn't hurt to Google them. I know the 5-second thing that I was talking about. I was building a service on a Linux system I didn't know too much about, and I had some sort of name server problem.
Yeah.
So it was like a DNS resolution timeout. And this was before I'd heard of strace. So I just knew that I was doing a simple network call, and it was always failing after 3 seconds. And I wasn't getting a nice OS message that was like, your name server doesn't exist or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was just like, we tried to talk the internet and we failed.
Right.
And with something like strace, which we should probably dig into in a minute, you can tell not only was it the network, but it was the part of the network where you try to resolve a host name. Mm-hmm. And it's 3 seconds, and they wind up Googling, you know, 3-second timeout Ubuntu and found something about DNS.
Yeah.
So it's something, you know, we have sort of said there's been a lot of things. We all have stories, right?
Right. Yeah.
So one of the things Daniel mentioned beforehand was having like a test journal. Mm-hmm. And I've actually found that I have kept notes over the years of debugging, especially when it's a particular problem, because those notes, they will come back up.
Yeah, that is great. For me, I mostly do it live, like in a spreadsheet, if I'm in a high-pressure debugging situation. Right. Like, I don't know, I broke production and it's Saturday morning or something.
Yeah.
And so I wind up, I found times when the stress levels go up, I panic sometimes and I wind up doing the same thing and then I'll do 10 other things and it's half an hour later and it's still broken and I wind up doing something I've already done before.
Right.
And once I realize I'm starting to retrace my steps, and I thought, oh, I really should just open up a spreadsheet and write down everything I did. It's like hypothesis XYZ, test ABC, results here.
Yeah. Right.
So then you can start to narrow it down, and then that's something really useful to share with the next person when you wind up asking, you know, phoning a friend. Like, here's all of my, and especially if you write down not just, it's not this, it's not that, but I think it's not this, and here's my experiment.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really like what you're saying about having a long-term journal. Mm-hmm. I've been slowly reading through the site reliability engineering book that Google released this last year.
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned, they have a whole big formal process on incident logging and resolution. And I've been inspired by that just to write down simple stuff. Like if I wind up doing Linux troubleshooting for one of our services, once I figure it out, or if I don't, I'll write up a one pager and put it on a wiki.
Yeah. Yep.
And there's a point to be made that every single time I wind up writing that page, I should have just fixed the problem permanently instead. But especially in an agency situation, you don't always have the budget or priority to just go make the problem go away. I'm not a full-time operations team with primary responsibility is making that problem never happen again.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think the you mentioned production debugging, so just a little bit on that, like, you know, there's been some recent social media things of, like, people deleting databases in multiple instances, right? I won't name names, but, like, it's happened, and it happens. There's going to be a point in your dev career where you hit enter on a command,
right?
And you start sweating profusely because you realize that you ran it against production instead of dev or staging.
Absolutely.
Or you see that, like you said, as soon as you click send on that email, like, you just like, oh no, a typo. Well, like, a typo can mean disastrous things on production, right? So, like, one bad RMRF and, like, everything's gone.
Yeah.
Right?
And those are
so you have to be super careful. And I like to buddy debug when it's production.
Absolutely.
If it's like a,
absolutely,
you know, if it's a production issue that's live, ongoing, high priority, like you said, like, you don't want to do the same thing 10 times. You don't want to go down the wrong path too far because you've got users who are affected and things like that. And so I really like to have a second pair of eyes, not in their own terminal, just sitting right next to you to make sure you don't do anything dumb. It doesn't always work, but, you know, it just gives that extra layer of...
That's a good point, too, as far as priorities. If you're saying that this bug is a big enough deal to take me away from my existing daily production or daily coding responsibilities, then it's not a big leap to say it's also worth doing that to the developer next to me. It's like, well, if this is going to interrupt my day, it's going to interrupt this person's day too, because you've already said it's a big deal, so we can't just trust one person to get it right without some oversight.
Yeah.
And we really want to get it handled. So,
you know, that's another thing, though, too, is having someone else. There's a practice out there called the rubber duck debugging. And the idea is, if you don't have someone else there, have a rubber duck or something at your desk that you describe the problem to.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I can't count the number of times when I have called someone over. I in describing the problem to them, mm-hmm. realize what the problem is.
Right.
It's because by describing, you have to get in more detail. You don't state your assumptions because they don't have them. Mm-hmm. So then you start saying all the things, and that's when you realize, oh. Even if you don't get to that point and mm-hmm. you don't figure it out, someone else will still be able to start asking other questions that can sort of make you trigger your thoughts or, yeah. oh, you're right. Yeah, I didn't set that other thing up yet. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, whatever.
Yep. Yeah. Back to reproducibility. If mm-hmm. you can't reproduce it, the next best thing, and this goes, you know, without saying in general, but logging. You know, if you can't fix something, you should always do something with a ticket.
Yeah.
In my experience, you know, like yeah. there's nothing good in saying like, well, I couldn't figure it out. Like, at least start logging assertions around things yeah. that should be true that are not, that you think maybe somewhat are related to this. You know, mm-hmm. you're like, hey, if this guy doesn't have an IP address and I'm parsing IP addresses, but he should always have one. Well, maybe I should log all the things that I know about at yeah. that moment when I figure out there's no IP address, even if it doesn't break it, you know, mm-hmm. you just let the request through, do what it needs to do, but at least yeah. logging it to some sort of, you know, log table or file that you're monitoring so that you mm-hmm. can be like, oh, it came in, and you'll start to see a pattern emerge at some right. point where you're like, it's always from this user, or it's always mm-hmm. from this mm-hmm. obscure Opera version, or like one of my favorite ones, it was this weird JavaScript bug that I got long ago, and it was from like the... it was from like the Wii U browser.
What?
And I was like, what? Like, it took forever to realize, like, what was going on? But it was like it was from like the Wii browser, not even Wii U. I think it was like right. super old or whatever. So this was years ago. But it was just so obscure. I was like, oh my gosh. Like, because you finally start digging around in the request and you're like, oh yeah, like it always works from like 99% of our users. And right. there's just one guy who always bombs out. And then you start like threading it through and you're like, oh, his user agent says like Dolphin or something. And you're like, what? What? Like, what's
yeah.
happening?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Anyway, it's stuff like that. So logging yeah. is super important. If you can't fix it, log as much as you can so that when mm-hmm. you come back with fresh eyes later, you've got somewhere to start and a pattern can start to form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. we do that a lot. I mean, in my time here at ClueFunction, I've seen that 3 or 4 times. Just something crops up. You have no idea how you got there, but you know that you could go back into that code, and at that point where that exception bubbles up, even though you can't fix it, you can say, there's 15 things I should be able to see about the state of the running right. system right now. Right. Log all of that, right?
Yep.
It's like, what do I wish I had known when this happened so I could debug it?
Exactly.
It's not, it doesn't really solve the problem, but at yeah. least it gives you something. Maybe you can say, maybe the next time will be the last time.
Yeah. I actually have a pet peeve around some of those, like, it was mentioned, if you have a bug that you can't figure out what the problem is.
Uh-huh.
I've seen a few cases where people are tempted to go in and maybe manually change a production database
Ooh.
To fix the bleeding on this one specific Ooh. Issue and never find what the root cause is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, man, you know, sometimes you've got to do that, right? Like maybe there's a financial issue or there's something yeah. where it's like someone can't log in or whatever. It's like, okay, yeah. great. But don't just do that.
Oh yeah.
Let's make it a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Let's, you know, Boy Scout principle here, leave it better than when you found it. If that means adding logging, then great. But
yeah. Yeah, because sometimes, like you said, user accounts, I think I remember one where like someone couldn't log in, their account kept getting disabled. And like yeah. no one would claim responsibility for it being disabled or whatever. And it was some bug in like some automatic code that's supposed to disable accounts that haven't been used in right. like so long or something, right?
So, what,
but it was just one of those things where like you logged when things went from not disabled to disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, oh, like the system did it. Like, what yeah. does that mean? And then you go, and then of course you're able to unravel it and figure yeah. out that, oh, there's this system job. Like, because, you know, at first you're like, well, someone in your organization must be disabling right. your user account. Right. Like, go talk to Bob. But, like, Bob doesn't know what's happening because mm-hmm. it's a system.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
yeah. So
if it's the first of the month at midnight, it's probably not an end user. Right?
Yeah.
It's another one of those psychic like, debugging
these are,
things.
Yeah. These are like the, you know, like you said, the psychic stuff that you figure mm-hmm. out. You're like, well, I doubt he was online at 1 a.m. on, yeah. on a Sunday, you know, like, yeah. probably not him.
Right. Right.
You know, but conveniently, I have all these jobs that run on Sunday. At 1
it's one of those. It's like, I mean, on logging, effective mm-hmm. logging, having a good timestamp. I mean,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, it's you'd be surprised what knowing what time something happens yeah. actually matters, especially for those sorts of bugs.
I still misinterpret that stuff. If I see a bunch of errors coming at 3 a.m., I'm like, man, we must have a lot of users in Russia I didn't know about. yeah. And every time it's that I'm running some automated job. I'm like, oh, it was me. Never mind.
Right. Right.
You should fire hose your log stuff, by the way. Like, you know, don't just add like log dot, you know, variable like in a bunch of places. Like if errors happen, you should log as much as you can, you know, as long as you're not in like a PCI environment or something like that, right? But like that's where like Sentry and Raygun and Crashalytics on like mobile and things like that, right? Like you want something else. You want to just shotgun blast out everything that you can possibly know in the safest way you can to some centralized server, whether it's hosted internally or in the cloud, so that, you know, you have a better chance of figuring it out. Because along with that comes stack traces and a lot of these places for like compiled code, you can upload your like PDB, your like actual like debugging symbols and stuff to those servers, like on a Sentry and things like that, so that when you get a crash in from like a compiled, you know, production code on like an iOS device, you can still see like where it's calling, because every time you release a build, you push those up to that server as well. Cool. So, you know, tooling's important, even with logging, like just get it all.
Speaking of tooling, I was really curious about what Mo said as far as updating data in production. Yeah, it's usually not the right idea, but if you do find yourself needing to do it, I like to do it by writing up a script to do the thing,
right?
And then maybe checking that in, and then deploying it up through staging and then production. So you say, Friday at 4 o'clock, I needed to unlock Joe again, so I ran the unlock Joe script. I didn't just make the problem go away.
Right, yeah. Well, the benefit even there is, you know, it's the having those things so that That gets back to the bus problem, you know. Whatever thing you did to fix it, make sure someone else also knows how to do that later.
Yeah, and on the flip side, anything that you touch in production outside of the regular flow of the system, don't allow yourself to do it until you've thought through and hopefully written out the plan to undo it. Because I know I've been there before where I wished 2 weeks later, man, I wish I had any plan for backing this out.
Yeah, right. Small companies, what you were just saying is the bus problem. Like, that's a huge problem that I find is like, you know, if so-and-so's account gets locked out every month, like you might just have that one guy who just unlocks it. He hits, he opens up SQL or Postgres. He writes his SQL statement to unlock Joe, and then he forgets about it till the next month. And he doesn't care to automate it because it's not a big deal.
Right.
But it's a big deal when he's no longer there. Mm-hmm. And it's a big deal when you've got 50 of them with like five different developers all spread across. They're all doing 10 things a month that no one's really realized. And like, you don't realize how bad that can hurt like the organization. And also, you know, like, we understand you want to keep a job, but you know, let's not go to drastic effects of just like running like random shell scripts, you know, at 3 a.m. every like third Thursday, you know, to make the system work like it's supposed to. Like these need to be worst case documented in some sort of like shared wiki or the repository markdown file, you know, like, hey, we run these things. We're not really sure why. We don't really care or have the resources to fix it right now, but like this fixes the problem for every month, you know, at least document this stuff so that someone else can do it.
When I worked on a team at a shop that had a mainframe, there was a lot of that, where people would have documented processes, whether it be named and numbered programs on the system or in a binder or whatever. But to actually execute that type of repetitive work, they would call downstairs and say, hey, I need you to run program XYZ, and then they do it. So at least then you've sort of broken that chain.
Right. Yeah.
Now, to go further with that, again, back to this Google book, which I'm not super far into, they have a specific concept of toil in their operating group. And toil is basically any kind of repetitive work that doesn't add value. Okay. So all these scripts you described are toil. And when I said earlier, whenever I find myself pasting the solution into a wiki, I feel bad because I know I should just make the problem never happen again, right?
Right. Yeah.
So they've got very high-level rules for the organization, and one of them is no more than 50% of any individual's or any team's time per period should be toil.
Interesting.
So
I
it's
like that.
Accepted that some amount of manual intervention is required to keep a system running, but if it goes above 50%, then you're fighting a losing battle, and they reserve that other 50% for building tools to scale themselves up. So maybe this level of 21 hours a week of toil helps our team maintain 15 servers, but we want to have 100 servers, so we're going to have to build a new thing that automates half of our toil so we can get back down to 10 hours a
really,
week per person.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, and it's you can't always imagine that porting to a certain different team configurations or sizes.
Sure,
like if you're a one-man shop, or for our team, we've got, what, four, five, six developers and no dedicated sysadmin. I'm not sure I mean, I'd still try to call that sort of thing out. Like, here's me doing something that's good for the company, good for the product, but it's not value added per se. Mm-hmm. It's just more time lost in service of protecting one sort of our products.
Opportunity cost there a little bit. It's I could have been spending this time on something else.
On a feature,
but,
right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about tools a little bit. Mo, you're our resident tool guy for the most part, or at least in my mind, you are. What Windows tools? Let's do it by OS. Like, sort of what's your favorite go to Windows tools for debugging, you know, obscure issues?
Well, there's a ding. It depends here on what category of thing I'm trying to debug. But if we're talking strictly code that you have source to, I'm just going to start with Visual Studio and the debugger. I'll add some breakpoints in there.
Yep.
There are other categories of things past that, though. The next one, and this is I love the sysinternals tools, sysinternals.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Those were from a guy named Mark Rusinovich, who's now a senior technical fellow. He's one of the smartest guys at Microsoft, basically.
Okay.
Microsoft bought them. And sysinternals, they're all free, but you can find just about anything that happens on your Windows box. They have tools for, like, see all the listing, all the processes listed, all the DLLs loaded, all the files opened in that process.
Right.
They have, that's called Process Explorer. There's Process Monitor, which anything that your process does, whether it's open a file, touch registry, touch the network, you can see low-level things about that. So if you've got some sort of weird permission bug that is sporadic, then you can load up Process Monitor and say, hey, I want to filter on this type of event.
Yeah.
And when this happens, throw it to a log. Mm-hmm. You will get millions of rows in that thing till you filter it down. But it's to what Jesse was saying earlier about log everything you can.
Right.
I mean, you're at your wit's end as soon as you, like, get out of the debugger, generally speaking, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If you can't just debug it yourself and it's some obscure permission, like, you're just understand it's not going to get easier. Like, you are down the rabbit hole. It's unlikely you're going to come up anytime soon. Like, it's time to open up these tools, and yeah, they're going to fire hose you with a ton of data.
Yeah.
But, you know, at least you have it. Like, it's better than not having it and just taking wild guesses at it.
And again, that's the perfect time to write down your notes. Yeah. This is how I got to the edge of my system.
Yes.
There's still no obvious answer here. So that's when you got to say, do you bring in another person and double down and keep digging? Or do you maybe go back to whoever's signing the checks and say, I've already put in half a day on this. This could take a week. Are you sure?
Right.
Can we turn this off and just call it a wash for now? Or should start building an alternate path now? It might be quicker to re-implement something that doesn't touch this broken part than to try and fix it.
Yeah, if it's like a permission problem and you're writing to the temp directory and, like, you're having permission problems, maybe it's time to, like, just do it in memory, right? Like, if it's not a crucial piece of the system, like, maybe you just start writing to a stream of memory instead of writing to a disk. Like, you know, always look for a way out that, you know, if you're past your, like, wit's end on it, you know, look for a way out that doesn't involve that third-party gem, that third-party service or DLL or you know, the file system, if it doesn't make sense, you know, is your architecture right? Like, yeah, I know it. Everyone wants to fix the problem, right? Mm-hmm. You want to know why it's broken, but at some point you got to cut your losses because you are getting, unless you're working for yourself, you're getting paid to do it, right?
Yeah. And even if you're doing it for yourself, assuming you're running a business, you've got your opportunity cost.
Absolutely. Yeah. The last category of tools on Windows anyway would be, memory dump debugging with the WinDBG, which I can count on both hands how many times I've probably had to pull that out.
Right.
That is when almost every time I've used it now, I have pretty detailed steps, like, in my log, my debugging journal, if you will, just because it is very low level. I'm not using it enough day to day to remember what the commands are. There are good resources online, but it is not user-friendly.
Right.
I would challenge almost anyone, if you're pulling that out, there probably is a better tool to use. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where make sure you're solving the right problem or you know, before you go to that. I would absolutely call someone else over before I pull WinDBG out.
Yeah, when you get that far in Windows, if you're like a .NET developer, right? Like that may be more of a tool chain of someone who's doing a lot of C or C++. Mm-hmm. Like they might use that a lot more often. But for .NET, if you're pulling out WinDBG, it's probably going to end up in a Microsoft support ticket before it's over. Like that's how that's worked for me in the past. Like if you get to that point, generally speaking, you're like, I think I might have actually found something that is a bug in IIS or in like... you know, in .NET itself, and then suddenly you've got a ticket out to Microsoft.
So just in terms of personas, so maybe if you're building a game on C#, you might be more comfortable or expecting that as opposed to building a web app?
The times that I've used memory dumps, there's sort of two categories. One is when I was doing, I had some client software, so it was .NET Forms, and one computer out of literally thousands in the enterprise. Ecosystem there in the enterprise had a problem.
Okay.
So we got a memory dump so that because we could reproduce it anywhere.
So you threw it away because computers cost less than a week of developer time.
No. But I did spin up a VM that I was able to reproduce it at that point.
Okay.
Once I had a memory dump of the category. Huh. And it was a specific mixture of patches on this machine.
Huh.
The other times that I've used WinDBG are for like ASP.NET hangs in IIS, where it's like, I don't know why it's hanging.
Right.
I don't know where it's hanging.
It's left my code.
It's left my code, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, and of that category, like Jesse said, at least one to two of those have resulted in at least a support ticket with Microsoft. So, yeah, it's very rare. I mean, so.
Yeah. For .NET, it's a lot easier to turn to, like, just IL debug view or whatever. I forget what it's called. Like, I rather look at IL than, like, a memory dump most of the time. Like, I'd rather be like, what is it actually doing? And I can't really read IL, but I'd rather look at IL than WinDBG.
I've never messed with IL, but when you say that, I'm thinking it's kind of like when I've used something like Strace on Linux.
Yeah.
Like, if most everything you're doing is implemented in terms of low-level calls to libc on your operating system, like, go make this network call to this port to this host name. You can see if you squint at the strace output, like maybe it's a one liner in Ruby and it's 50 lines in strace, but you'll see the one that's do this and there's a suspicious constant of 3,000 milliseconds before the DNS timeout.
Right.
It's right there on the page if you find the right debugger.
Last Windows tool for me is Wireshark.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I didn't even think that's another category.
For networking stuff. Fiddler. Sure. Fiddler is a much higher level abstraction of network debugging. Absolutely. If you just need to know, like, what's happening. You know, like, if you want to look at requests and replay requests and stuff like that, it's a lot easier to use Fiddler to kind of inspect what's coming in and out of your system and work from there. It even does SSL decryption and stuff like that. Wireshark is much lower level, but at the same time, you get more detail, and that could be super useful.
I find that type of tool like Fiddler to be really useful for building test suites.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
It can be a lot easier to capture a perfectly formed request as it leaves your system and then just replay that later than to capture all the code paths you went through to generate it.
Yeah.
Like I was building
an integration test, right?
We had a webhook processing thing on one of our Ruby apps recently, and the vendor changed their webhook payload completely. It went from 50 lines to 500. And I was really happy. When I went through to re-implement it, I noticed that the existing implementation had about 5 or 10 JSON fixtures. These are all the various types of payloads we're seeing for different states, and you can replay them against the test suite. I was really happy about that. So I imagine you could do something like that with Fiddler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So Wireshark, by the way, is also cross-platform. So depending on whichever Windows, Mac, Linux, like Wireshark will work on all of those. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Linux and or Ruby debugging tools then.
Okay. First off, I'll say that I tend to do my Ruby work at a console with Vim.
Mm-hmm.
I use Pry as
an
interpreter with breakpoints. And with that in place, I hardly ever touch a real debugger like you might see in Visual Studio.
So I've used in Rails projects RubyMine.
Mm-hmm.
And it has debuggers and breakpoints, and it feels more like Visual Studio. But I will say, once I began using Pry, I think I got more comfortable with it because it sort of changes the way that you debug, because you can start, given that it's an interpreted language, you can ask the state of your project. You just type in some Ruby on your Pry command, and you can start doing a lot more things right there, or even change the state of things. And
There's a famous essay out there that describes programming as theory building.
Mm-hmm.
So from a debugging perspective, the fact that you're debugging means that your original theory was flawed, right? Yeah. So if you jump right into a prize session or in Visual Studio or the immediate window,
yeah,
and you start inspecting all your objects, poking around at the method signatures and APIs you have directly available to you, then you can start making really quick, you know, barely conscious tests, just trying to reshape your theory and test things out and figure out where you're going.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's the way I build things from the ground up in Ruby, and also how I debug stuff where I can.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah, something I'll do. So it does feel, so have y'all heard the phrase poor man's debugger?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, putting print statements throughout your code, because sometimes that's all you can do.
Right.
But it sometimes has felt like that, especially when I was first getting into Rails. Like, mm-hmm, that's all probably was. But there's a lot more to it.
Oh, yeah.
You can do things like, you know, put an if statement around your pry statement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that way you see someone who's new to pry, they may have it break every single time. But it's, yeah, like, no, only break in the times when you want.
Yeah.
You know, jump to the error case, mm-hmm, right away.
Yeah, I'll do that with a dependent clause, like binding up pry if the broken thing is broken.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
There is, again, in pry, there's a locals, mm-hmm, method, mm-hmm, which is basically like the auto watch debuggers in Visual Studio. You can see what are the local variables, right, in this scope.
Yep.
And then you can poke around on them. You can't as easily view them as you would in a real GUI, but you can see it. And there's a pry plugin, pry bybug or debug or something, yeah, that lets you do next and continue. So I guess you're getting close to being like GDB, which I haven't used in 10 years, but
yeah,
it's not as, you don't really feel like you have the whole God's eye view as you might in a real visual debugger, but it's something.
Yeah, I don't know. I find it better like pry than like the integrated like RubyMine stuff as well. Like,
yeah.
Like I've used it before. For one thing, it always seemed like it was really complicated to get like RubyMine, yeah, debugging set up.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, the gem combination was just always like confusing,
yeah,
for some reason. Like
if you've got Foreman or something, system,
it wanted it. Yeah. Yeah, and like, yeah, you get into like the Foreman stuff as well, yeah, which that's one reason probably to use the RubyMine stuff, because they can still do debugging even if you launch it through Foreman, I think.
Huh.
Where like, yeah, in Pry, you've got to launch it in a separate, yeah, you know, something, right, else. Otherwise, so, it's just stuck.
Would you say this is like a Heisenbug where by attempting to observe it, you changed it? Or is it more that certain types of tooling just add so much friction that they're almost not worth it?
It's the friction for me, personally.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I see the same thing. Like, if I'm working with somebody who just insists on using not pry or this particular editor, and they come to me with a problem, and I say, well, I run it on my system when I'm not using that editor or whatever, and it doesn't happen, mm-hmm, then I'm happy to provide them with that data point, but that really kills my motivation to help me figure out why it doesn't work on their machine. I'm like, you're using this tool I don't even like, and it doesn't work for you, and it does work for me, so I don't know what to tell you.
Nice.
I didn't even think of this, but, you know, another category of debugging tools is, you know, in the browser,
mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm,
the Chrome developer tools.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got a REPL, read, eval, print loop, right there in your browser.
Right.
Hopefully in your browser anyway. I guess all the major browsers ship with something like that now.
Yeah. Yeah,
but,
they do.
You know, you can put console log statements in your client-side code. You, mm-hmm, can set breakpoints in most of them. So all of those things we're talking about there, you can do in your browser.
Yeah.
So that's another one that's pretty common.
It gets a little crazy in browsers.
It does.
Because,
it does.
Because everyone, you know, now you've got Babel transpiling to like,
transpiled.
You know, and then you've got to output the map files, mm-hmm, but then depending on how it's set up, like if you're using something like React, then you usually have like a Webpack server that actually generates those. But then if you're not using it, then you've probably like spit them out at the bottom of the you know, the actual files inside of like a Base64 encoded version of the map files, or they have to be output on disk, and like that slows down like the gulp processes. I mean, so JavaScript's insane a lot anyway, right? But like debugging really shows the seams of like how bad that can be sometimes.
I will say stepping through in Chrome, it's almost tractable, but if you're just trying to do console log debugging with like modern client-side JS, you'll find out that everything you're writing is a 10-line callback that's invoked by
a state machine.
Invoked by an anonymously named framework function. So I have no idea where I am or how I got here.
Yeah.
But I recognize this one line of code, so
in the newest Visual Studio Code, so it can do JavaScript debugging as well, right? Mm-hmm. And I did notice in their latest drop that just dropped, I think this week, or maybe just at the end of last week, they actually have async, like, callback unwinding.
Like, really?
The call stack when you're in an async method is no longer just like async with no stack. Like, it knows where you came from. I'm not sure what black magic they integrated, because Chrome's been working on stuff like this for a long time and they didn't do it. So I'm expecting that they will now that they've probably seen how Microsoft's doing it.
Yeah.
But that looks great, at least in the screenshot. I haven't used it. But
I haven't seen that.
The fact that you can actually see where it came from with, when you've got, you know, 10 promises deep or whatever.
Speaking of, seems like some sort of aspect-oriented thing we would have to inject before and after every method. Like, I am leaving this, I'm entering that, and then just have it unwind, follow your breadcrumbs if it was automated.
Like three or four stacks of function calls or something.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned VS Code, Visual Studio Code, I think can actually do visual debugging with Ruby now as well.
Mm-hmm. I've used it there before.
There are times when when I like having a visual debugger is whenever I'm not as familiar with the code, because I can see a lot more of the code.
Right.
It's sort of like, I just want to step through and see where execution is even going.
Right.
Yeah.
That's when I like having a visual debugger.
Yeah, like if you already have a mental model for what all the different modules and classes in the system are, you probably don't want to go back and reread them every time.
Yeah.
But if you're like, what is this thing? Is that a class? Is that a module? Yeah, is that a gem?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That makes
sense. I think we're running low on time. One thing I've been wanting to ask, I know I put a point up there about TDD and we just kind of touched on that, but, and this probably overlaps in one of our previous episodes about maintainable software, but what do you guys do to be proactive about making code that can be debugged? Like, one for me, there's one of the classic things, like, if you have a line of code that's doing 10 things, then you know when it blows up in the interpreter or whatever, you're going to see line 100 breaks, and you say, oh, well, everything's happening in here. For me, I want to break it up into 10 lines, so I can at least see which of those many things I've chained together is the one that went wrong. So what do you guys do for that?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one thing, you know, breaking up your code and making sure that the methods that are doing the work are named properly, so that like when you look at a call stack, you can be like, how did I get here? Instead of it being like, you know, just a bunch of initializers and stuff like that, like making methods that are small and to the point, you know, seeing those in a call stack helped me a lot to get my bearings. I'm like, okay, I put a breakpoint here because this is where it's happening, but if I don't know the system, then I'm not really sure how we got here. And so looking at a nice clean call stack and everything being named the way you would expect, you know, you're like, oh yeah, request started, and then I created a person, and then I called person set first name, and here I am, you know, and you're like, oh, okay, like, this makes sense, you know, instead of it just being like an initializer that was over the span of, you know, 10 lines, but it was all the initialize, right?
Something else that I try to do is to make it clear where side effects are in my code.
Okay.
So, for example, I'm going to try to not make, say, a API call or a database call in a constructor or in a property getter or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't want, as I'm going through and debugging this code, all of a sudden a call to the database. I want to have a very clear interface of where save happens, for example, or where delete or something like that, so that I can sort of look at that in isolation.
Yeah.
Side effects are those sorts of things are can mess up a debugging session so much more than when they're isolated well.
Yeah. For me, it's all about minimizing the problem space. Like, eliminate as many things as you can. Process of elimination. I know Jesse mentioned earlier in the episode something about assertions. And that reminds me of something I've read about, never tried, is contract-based programming.
Yeah.
And the way I understand it, it's just a lot of assertions and guard clauses and whatnot. Like, entering this block of code, I insist that these 1, 2, 3, 4 things are all true, and if they're not, I refuse to play your game, right?
Yep.
Now that I've finished, I guarantee that these 4, 5, 6 things are all true. And if they're not, then don't trust me because I'm not implemented I think I am. And that is kind of the style of the confident code I try to write, is here are all the things that have to be true. Now that we know they're true, I can do my thing without having to do nearly as much special casing and branching. It's like, we're there. We get rid of all the edge cases. Now we're doing the happy path.
Yep.
Now we're cleaning up and leaving.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, just to kind of wrap up, I do like to write test after the fact, once you figured it out. Like, obviously, if you can write a test that hits the problem area of code instantly and you think you'll be able to like mock out or change the input parameters to trigger the test,
right.
then that's the great place. That's the first place I like to start, right? If it's broken out enough, I'm like, oh yeah, this is null. It shouldn't be, but we should be handling it more graceful. Then mm-hmm. write a test that says like, yeah, we don't blow up when this is null. Uh-huh. And then you make that test pass. But, doing that will tell you where it doesn't really work out. You know, you're like, oh yeah, it's calling to the database or it's calling an API. And so sometimes that's not the best, but that's where I start to break things up mm-hmm. more. You know, that's what, you know, if that's where a problem area was, then I like to try to abstract away all those external dependencies mm-hmm. and those hidden gems, I guess, of where saves happened and you didn't realize it and things like that. You know, you want to pull those away.
Yeah. Another thing that gets me still after years is I don't often enough falsify my tests. Like, all right, given right. everything does what right. I think it's going to do, then this passes. But you can look at it and say, if you deleted that entire method, your test would still be green.
Yeah.
Like, because you just went around it and didn't actually yes. prove anything.
That's easy to do. You also, maybe, it depends on the system, but sometimes you want to have a test that's like, you test every single iteration possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of an art there to getting just the right number of tests while actually covering enough cases.
Yeah. And I think there may be another episode for us on the art of TDD.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Do you guys have any other points or issues you want to go over?
I think the final thing I'd say that we have written up there is it's probably your code.
That's yeah. right. That's right.
You know, it's unlikely to be like the OS. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had a couple of those where it's like, oh yeah, this looks like a .NET bug or an IIS bug. And like, but most of the time I'm wrong.
Yeah.
There's been like, I think one time where it's ever been like submitted and they're like, yeah, that appears to be a defect with these 8 patches in exactly this order.
Yeah.
But like, you know, every other time it's eventually been my fault.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
someone's fault on the team. So and
if you don't have several days of meticulously logged testing and a reproducible test case, right. it's not the OS. I mean, in some case, for somebody, yes. it's going to be the OS, yes. but it's not going to be you if you're 5 minutes in and you yeah. haven't really proven all the edges.
Don't yeah. jump to the conclusions, Matt, yet.
Yeah.
It might be, but assume that it's yours first.
That sounds like a good place to end it. We'll see yeah. you guys next time.
Yep. Check us out on Twitter at ClearFunction with the hashtag #ItDepends.
See you guys.
Thanks.
You've been listening to It Depends, a podcast by Clear Function. Clear Function is a group of happy engineers based in Memphis, Tennessee. We partner with visionaries to bring their ideas to life. For more information, check out our website at clearfunction.com.